You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello and welcome to Bookworm. This is Michael Silverblatt. Today's show is the third in a series on writing, nature, and community. We taped at the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. during the Watershed Conference, which was sponsored by Robert Haas, who is the nation's poet laureate, the Orion Society, and the Library of Congress. Today my guests are Scott Russell Sanders and Robert Michael Pyle. They write essays about the natural world. When Robert Michael Pyle searches for Bigfoot, he's really on the quest for some mythic purity, a sense akin to childhood wonder. When Scott Russell Sanders looks for a center, he's searching for truths and connections to hold together a broken world. Because their voices may be new to you, here they are reading from their work. First, Scott Russell Sanders reading from the preface of Writing from the Center, published by the University of Indiana Press.
How can one live a meaningful, gathered life in a world that seems broken and scattered? That question has haunted me for as long as I can remember. Insofar as I have found an answer, it has to do with understanding my place in marriage, family, and community, my place on earth, and ultimately in creation. To be centered, as I understand it, means to have a home territory, to be attached in a web of relationships with other people, to value common experience, and to recognize that one's life rises constantly from inward depths. This book is about glimpsing and seeking and longing for that center, that condition of wholeness. My home territory is southern Indiana, in the watershed of the Ohio River, and so, in writing about where I belong, I focus on the landscape and culture of the Midwest. The skies in my pages are filled with thunderstorms and red-tailed hawks. The creeks are bordered by limestone bluffs. The fields are planted in soybeans and corn. The woods are thick with grapevines and hickories. Wishing to know my place, I read its literature, to see how this region has been imagined by writers who stayed here, as well as by those who moved away. Although I speak of the Midwest, my deeper subject is our need to belong somewhere with a full heart, wherever our place may be, whoever our people may be.
Scott Russell Sanders, reading from Writing from the Center. He's the author, as well, of Staying Put and the Secrets of the Universe, published by Beacon Press. My second guest is Robert Michael Pyle, reading from The Thunder Tree, published by Houghton Mifflin.
Everybody's Ditch. A green ravine creases northeast Seattle, draining into Lake Union near the University of Washington. My mother grew up in a white shingle house beside this ravine, and it became her constant haunt. Whenever she was able to return to Seattle, Mother's first impulse was to visit her ravine. On one of these pilgrimages, she took me along, and I saw in her face the meaning of place. At Ravenna Park, she made a personal connection that transformed the way she looked at the land for the rest of her life. When people connect with nature, it happens somewhere. Almost everyone who cares deeply about the outdoors can identify a particular place where contact occurred. This may have been a wilderness, a national park, or a stretch of unbounded countryside. But more often, the place that makes a difference is unspectacular. A vacant lot, a scruffy patch of woods, a weedy field, a stream, a green ravine like Ravenna, or a ditch. My own point of intimate contact with the land was a ditch. Growing up on the wrong side of Denver, to reach the mountains easily or often, I resorted to the tattered edges of the Great Plains on the backside of town. There I encountered a century-old irrigation channel known as the Highline Canal. Without a doubt, most of the elements of my life flowed from that canal. From the time I was six, this weedy watercourse had been my sanctuary, playground, and sulking walk. It was also my imaginary wilderness, escape hatch, and birthplace as a naturalist. Later, the canal served as a lover's lane, a research site, and a holy ground of solace. Over the years, I studied its natural history, explored much of its length, watched its habitats shrink as the suburbs grew up around it, and tried to help save some of its best bits. Despite the losses, the High Line remained a place to which I would often return. And even when living in national parks, in exotic lands, in truly rural countryside, and in Seattle near Mother's Ravine, I've hankered to get back to the old ditch whenever I could.
Robert Michael Pyle, reading from The Thunder Tree. He's the author as well of Where Bigfoot Walks, and is editing a collection of Vladimir Nabokov's writings on butterflies. My two guests have in common the discovery of a love of wilderness in childhood, a special relationship to home places, a writing about parents as mentors and influences. I thought I'd begin with childhood. Is it where your imagination as a writer begins?
Yes, Michael, it certainly is for me. I remember times out in the garden with my mother when she would reach down into the soil and pull out a little golden sphere and say, "Bobby, this is a cocoon. Something beautiful will come out of this." Now, that doesn't take a leap of imagination for a young boy, 3 or 4 years old, to wrap his head around, or for a girl to be told by her mother that when a butterfly flies over, it formerly was a worm, as people commonly call them, or a caterpillar. For me, going out onto my ditch and finding butterflies, eventually, made the imaginative leap for me between that little golden sphere, the little cocoon, and the moth that might come from that, or the butterfly that might come from the chrysalis. I went on to study these things in a concrete way, and am able to bring to my writing a certain amount of scientific background, but quite frankly, that's a lot less satisfying to me in the long run than the imaginative approach, and I do think it came right out of my childhood and going out and getting my hands dirty and walking in the grass with bare feet.
Robert Michael Pyle. Scott Russell Sanders?
One of many memories that I carry from childhood that I've written about is seeing my father, when we would come to a new place, pick up a pinch of soil and rub it in his palm and sniff it and then lick it, tasting it. And when I would ask him why he did that, because that seemed like a strange thing to do, he said, "I'm just trying to find out where I am." Mm. And that rooting of oneself in the senses and in the place, actually tasting the place, taking it in through all your senses, is what children do instinctively. That's why parents have to go around trying to persuade their 2-year-olds not to eat everything they see. The impulse is not to consume the world, but to taste it, to experience it directly.
You each have a particular parent. I notice that in Thunder Tree, your mother and her place is central to you. I'm talking here to Robert Michael Pyle. And in Writing from the Center, your father appears, Russell Sanders, to be the tutelary spirit of writing. And I was wondering whether either of you have anything to say about the choice of the mentor's gender.
That's a very interesting question, Michael. I think in my case it was actually surprising that it might have been my mother, because she was absent for so much of my childhood.
Wow.
My family all respected words and reading, though my parents were not did not finish college because of the Depression, but they had books and they read, and they both cared about the out of doors. My father was an angler and my mother a gardener, but it was my mother who took me into that garden, and then she left when I was quite young and did not come back into my life until junior high school. So there were several years when she was absent, and yet though my father was encouraging, I honestly felt, I believe I can say, that all through that time it was kind of my mother's guiding spirit that took me out into the woods. When she came back, we were able to enjoy that together for the last few years of her life. But whether that pertains to her gender, I think it might. My other two great mentors were my grandmother and my great aunt. I've certainly had male mentors, the old butterfly collector who worked at Gates Rubber Company on the graveyard shift so he could collect butterflies all day. My brother to some extent, and my father to some extent. I suppose, though, to be very bald about it, I probably have had more female mentors than male. And I don't know what that says other than that I suppose there's a certain gentleness in the approach that has touched me. In Cub Scouts, the only thing I remember fondly, other than actual friends being there, are the den mothers. So the den mothers were trying to get us to take some sort of a gentle approach, and my buddies were all wanting to play war and catch things and break things. And I don't know. I hate to generalize about a female versus a male approach to the landscape, because I hope that I typify some of each. But I think I take something from what I, as a male, take to be something of a female gentleness toward the land.
I learned from both my parents and from many other mentors as well. But as I think about your question, Michael, I realized that my mother's domain was not only inside the house, but near the house. My mother was a woman of gardens, of flowers, of yards, of fruit trees, and of birds at the bird feeder. That was her domain, and I learned a great deal from her within that sphere. My father was the person whose domain started on the outside of the yard, in the scruffy fields, and then in the pastures, and then in the woods and the creeks and the river valleys. He was the one who loved to go camping and loved to go into the deep woods. My mother was the one who would much rather stay and work in her flower garden. That's a fairly traditional division of the landscape between men and women, and that they had a fairly traditional marriage. But I feel that between the two of them, I gained an appreciation for and learned to pay attention to both the near-to-home land and also the more remote and wilder land.
That might be taken as the dichotomy in the titles between two books, Staying Put, the mother book, and Secrets of the Universe, the father book.
I hadn't thought about that, right? It's, and for that matter, writing from the center, that title and that idea, it's the notion that one has a place and one is in a place, and the place includes relations with people, relations with work, relations with land, but from that place one makes journeys. One goes out in great circles and meets people or chases butterflies or learns from other traditions, but then you return to the home place. And perhaps that is a combination of the influences of the two parents.
Now, Robert Michael Pyle, I've gotten the feeling by looking through Where Bigfoot Walks, Crossing the Dark Divide, that part of the search is the desire for not absence, but mystery, as if part of what needs to complete a landscape or an imagination, the completing element is not Bigfoot, but the mystery of Bigfoot. And I guess, you know, mystery is at the heart of every kind of writing, it seems to me. And this book, Where Bigfoot Walks, is like the best kind of detective novel for a literary person, in that it does not provide a solution. As Edmund Wilson said, who cares who killed Roger Ackroyd? Or as someone else said, I think it was Jeffrey Hartman, that at a certain point, the whodunit became the whodonut, the mystery with a hole at the center, and this is the literary form of mystery. But could you speak about that, tracing the lost element?
Yes, Michael, I think you have it just right, as to what that book means to me and what I hope it might mean to readers. You know, when I could go out on the ditch as a kid, it wasn't difficult to imagine that between the banks and the tall grass overhanging the canal, in the dry season when I could walk down in the canal, that I might find astonishing discovery. And in fact, I did. I found butterflies from the mountains way out on the plains, which qualified as astonishing discovery, as did finding a bear track once on the plains. But you know, as we get older and as our universe contracts a little bit, it becomes more difficult, more limiting to try to find great mystery in our lives. Nabokov said that I am astonished how few people notice butterflies. Well, I certainly noticed butterflies, and I noticed that many others did not. One thing I noticed going to the Pacific Northwest was that where things are big, big mountains, big glaciers, big rainforests, big trees, people often don't notice the small. And yet one thing they do notice are things that might not even be there. I mean, the sense of Bigfoot permeates Northwest culture. And in fact, it's been degraded from the great honorable Indian traditions into sort of a tabloid subject and staple. I was wondering, Michael, if we couldn't reinvest something of the mystery that the Kwakutl and the Haida and the Bok Bok Wali Nuksiwe people of the great North British Columbian coast found in this presence. It's not certainly in my powers to revivify a myth, but at the same time, I thought if I could go forth and try to recapture in myself some of the same splendor in the presence of mystery. I don't think that's too strong a word. It's a splendid feeling to feel that you are in the presence of mystery, and it's something that I think most of us lack in most of our days. Then I would have gained something dramatic from the presence of an animal that might or might not even walk in flesh and blood. I hope to convey that in the book. Bigfoot is exactly that. I wasn't trying to find it or prove it or disprove it, but I was trying to say, is the power of the presence of this great archetype, if you will, still there? Can we still touch it, and can it touch us? And can it bring back some childishness to our imagination?
Robert Michael Pyle just mentioned Nabokov, about whom there is a, with whom there is a connection. He is a lepidopterist, and he's now editing a collection of writing that Nabokov has done about butterflies. But I did want to talk about literary mentorship, too. You, Scott, began your career, I believe, with a book about D.H. Lawrence.
Absolutely.
Who is, you know, in a certain sense, the demiurge of the spirit of place. He goes to Australia, to Mexico. Often he doesn't like it wherever he goes. His
yes.
first job is to be hostile to the environment. But he finds the spirit of place. What was his influence on you? And you adopted your own homeland.
Yes, Lawrence had a profound influence on me. I should begin by a disclaimer. I think many of Lawrence's ideas about politics, about women, are offensive. They trouble me. But I also think that Lawrence is able to evoke the lives of animals, the feeling of landscapes, and the sumptuous, sensual presence of nature more powerfully than any other 20th century writer I can think of. Even when he was wrong-headed about politics, I think he was profoundly right-hearted about land and creatures. And it was that, I believe, that I took from Lawrence, or learned from Lawrence. His rendering of a turtle, his rendering of the cedars in the Italian landscape, or his rendering of the desert in the American Southwest acknowledges the vitality, the power, and the mystery of those places or of those creatures. And it seemed to me that we inherit life on a continent which, if any continent is vital and filled with mysterious power, ours is, and that we have a lot to learn from a writer like Lawrence.
And you have decided at a certain point that the Midwest is
yes.
your home.
Yes.
You don't come from there.
Well, I was born in Tennessee, but I left Tennessee as a child and grew up in Ohio. So really, my formative years were Midwestern. A true Midwesterner, somebody out in Iowa or Kansas, would look on Ohio as practically New England. But but anything, my idea is anything west of the Allegheny Mountains is the Midwest until you get to the Rockies. So I thought of myself very much growing up in Ohio as a Midwesterner, but I went to college in New England, and I went to graduate school in Old England, spent 8 years away from the middle of the country, and assumed that I would not go back. I just assumed, for whatever reason, my education would take me to some exotic place. And yet my imagination drew me back to the Midwest. That was the place where I knew the creatures, I knew the landforms, I knew the smells, the fireflies, and where I knew the accents and the foods. And that was the place where, if I could do original work, if I could do work that would contribute to people's understanding of their place, it would happen there. So yes, I have deliberately chosen to be there and to make my art there.
Scott Russell Sanders, the author most recently of Writing from the Center. Robert Michael Pyle, author most recently of Where Bigfoot Walks. How do you decide where is home, and how do you decide on a home?
Michael, my home was in Colorado. I was born in Denver and grew up on the east side of Denver in the post-war suburbs. It felt like home because it's the only place I knew up until the time I was 18, but there was something missing, and it's something that I heard about constantly from my mother and my grandmother, who had been My grandmother had gone from Colorado Ranches out to Washington early in the century and had been a pioneer teacher there. My mother was brought up there, and what they spoke of was green and wetness and moss and ferns and things that were absent from my dry western Midwest landscape as a boy. So I felt as if, almost as if I had a gene in absentia for the damp lands, the western country beyond the rain shadow on the other side, on the wet side of the rain shadow. I went there for college and have ended up coming back to the Northwest again and again to live. And I've been living now for almost 17 years in a farmhouse down near the mouth of the Columbia River in 120 inches of rain. And that does feel like home. Although I must say, I go back to Colorado every year to dry out a little bit and to feel what that felt like and to smell those smells, you know. There's something about smell that makes a place home. And now, instead of the smell of a summer thunderstorm on dust or pavement or in the ditch, it's now the smell of constant moisture in the air that makes me feel home.
We're all here in Washington, D.C., where we're taping this, for a conference called Watershed. Its subtitle, Writers, Nature, and Community. One of the most remarkable things about the conference, Bob, is that while there's more than 40 writers speaking, I get none of the usual feeling of ego.
The feeling of ego, Barry Lopez once said to me, when I was going on the road for Wintergreen, he said, "Now, Bob, one thing you're going to find among the people out there is that people will expect writers to be gardening their reputations, and I think we're doing something more than that here." And he's very, very right. I don't find that sort of literary chicanery or puffery among nature writers. And by the way, we all tend to think of that as a pretty broad field, you know, sensu lato. Nature writing is either nothing, and there's no genre, whatever, or it's everything. It's all nature. You know, intensive urban writing is still about nature, but it might be about one or a few species, one or a few habitats. But the people who really do draw from the landscape, draw from other creatures, and from one another, there seems to be we are not without our egos, but we don't seem to concentrate on that so much as some people I know in some areas of the arts and other human activities. And part of it, too, I must add to that, is a relative absence of cynicism. When I come to these gatherings,
yes,
even though we're dealing with those subjects that might be expected to most promote cynicism, the ecological crisis, the loss of species and biodiversity, and the crumbling of communities, we come away somehow inflated in our hope rather than dejected. And that, I think, speaks to this company of writers.
Over and over again this week, I've heard ideas about storytelling and how the storytelling process seems to be integral, crucial, to the process of looking at the world carefully. That it's not enough to look. Part of the forming of a community involves the telling of stories. Can you explain that to me?
Stories are containers in which we carry meanings and understandings that we cannot carry in any other way. That is, a story cannot be reduced to some simpler meaning. It's the way that we understand our lives and our places. And stories also, when they work well, connect us to places. We understand where we are. We understand its history. We understand what matters and why it matters through the stories we carry. And when I say story, I, of course, include poems, essays, short stories, novels, all oral tales, all the ways that we tell about our places. Unless we have those stories, we don't know where we are, and we can't take care of our places.
You know, in 19th century fiction, Mark Twain, for instance, makes fun of lady writers who have three names. I mean, and a lot of the redress of feminist criticism has been to rescue those three-named writers from the ignominy into which they had been cast by usually male, rowdy writers like Mark Twain. But I notice that from Henry David Thoreau, Ralph Waldo Emerson, Edwin Waite Teal, down to my guests, Scott Russell Sanders and Robert Michael Pyle, there is a tradition of three-named naturalists. And does it have to do with the need to name, to have one's full name?
I have a simple explanation. There's another Scott Sanders who also writes. His middle name is Scott, is Patrick. Scott Patrick Sanders. He lives in, the last time I heard of him, in New Mexico. And we used to get mail crossed. Someone would look me up in a catalog and get his address and send something to him that was intended for me. And initially we agreed, we exchanged letters, we agreed that we would each use a middle initial. Well, P and R are so similar, that didn't help. So since then we agreed that in publishing and in public appearances we would use our full first name. And that's how mine started. Otherwise I'm plain old Scott Sanders.
And we also have Barry Holston Lopez and Ann Heyman Zwinger. Mm-hmm. I've got both the shorter and the slightly also short version of this coming from two different directions. One is the very same. I know three other Robert Piles, all of whom write. Robert W. Pyle wrote The Flora of Cape Cod, and Robert L. Pyle wrote The Birds of Hawaii. And there's another Robert Pyle wrote about roses. And then in the Trobriand Islands in New Guinea, I met another Robert M. Pyle writes on birds. So that's part of it, is for the same reason Scott said, to identify myself among the others. But, you know, I actively sought to emulate Edwin Way Teal and Joseph Wood Crouch and Roger Torrey Peterson. And so I was going to, actually, as a young and pretentious would-be writer, give myself a middle name. It started with M, but it was more naturey than Michael. I also had seen a statue of St. Michael stabbing a dragon, which I didn't like very much. So I was going to go with Moss or Marsh or something like that. Well, thank goodness I never did. I mean, that would be nice. But in time, I came to appreciate the fact that my parents probably had something in mind, and also that Michael has a nice cadence to it when interposed between Robert and Pyle. Something to dress up Pyle anyway, you know.
I have been speaking to Scott Russell Sanders, the author most recently of Writing from the Center, and Robert Michael Pyle, the author most recently of Where Bigfoot Walks. We've been here in Washington, D.C., at the Watershed Conference, Writers, Nature, and Community, and I want to thank you both for joining me.
It was a pleasure.
Thank you so much, Michael.
My engineer here at NPR is Suzanne Mesnick. Our engineer at KCRW is Jennifer Swadek. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. Next week, you'll hear David Quammen on the subject of extinction in a special series of readings by our poet laureate Robert Haas and several of the Watershed writers. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica.
Books can be funny too. Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse. Pop.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.